Welcome to Silicon Economics. Silicon Economics is a podcast where we explore the intersection of technology and economics. I'm Rob Soderbery, Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Flash Business here at Western Digital. With me is my co-host,
Adarsh Kannan, VP of Economics and Data Science here at Western Digital.
Adarsh and I are excited to bring you this episode. Let's jump in. Today, we're going to apply the Silicon Economics framework to the hottest topic in technology, which is AI, and specifically AI in the enterprise. And I couldn't be more thrilled to welcome Raj Shukla to the show. Raj, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Raj is one of those rare early adopters in AI, not jumping on the bandwagon, but straight out of college, diving into the deep end, and has had a tremendous run, most recently taken over CTO responsibility at Symphony AI. So give us a quick introduction to yourself, and let's start there.
Sure. So as you said, I just accidentally started doing machine learning. It was sort of up and coming. My background was computer science, and we started applying machine learning models to computer networks and anomaly detection in large-scale computer networks and so on. So that's how I started learning machine learning and so on. And so nothing very planned or whatnot, but kind of stumbled on it, but just loved the concept of things not being black and white and just like probabilistic and, there being a likelihood of something, and, started going into it. Came out of college, had a bit of a background in search or semantic search, landed in Microsoft Research, and from there to search and advertising divisions in Microsoft, and later on to Azure, and within Azure, Azure ML, and then various enterprise AI or business AI functions in Microsoft, including Power BI, Power Platform, Dynamics. So held, AI engineering leadership roles at Microsoft, and then decided, okay, it's my time to try something new, and Symphony AI came along the way, and I felt like the right choice. It just helped me carry on my interest and expertise in AI machine learning and apply it in the enterprise space, which I was very passionate about.
So Symphony AI is a super hot name in enterprise AI, but I think most people don't really understand what that means. Uh-huh. So what is it that Symphony AI is actually doing, and how does it help me as in the enterprise?
Absolutely. So Symphony AI is a enterprise AI SaaS company, which means we provide AI machine learning solutions, which users will see as applications, as APIs, or as simply dashboards that they use. These users are, there's a bunch of personas we serve, but more importantly, we are a vertical AI company, meaning we serve a few particular industries or verticals. And all our approach into what we provide as a SaaS solution is very verticalized. The main verticals we focused on are retail, that's our biggest one, financial services, and within that, specifically the financial crime segment. We have emerging verticals of manufacturing, industrial, media, and then business IT. So within these verticals, we focus on personas. You could focus on one persona, for example, in financial crime space, which is these people called the investigators who sit in banks, and they have a particular role to play, and their journey starts, when they're handed over a case and they have to do something, and then their journey ends in submitting a report. And whatever happens in the middle, we are there. And we want to make their decisions data and AI driven. And we provide essentially SaaS solutions to do that. And that's just an example, but that applies to, all the personas in all these industries that we work on.
Well, we definitely want to drive into the personas and the verticals, because that's where the rubber hits the road, the money gets made. But let's just sort of double click on the stacks. I assume there's some sort of a data layer, AI ML layers on top of that. What does that stack look like that you're taking into the vertical?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have a platform internally, which we call Eureka GenAI platform. And, you know, it really, we talk about it in four layers. So there is no AI without data. So you have to gather all the data. You have to transform the data before you start building machine learning models on it. So we have the data platform layer. Then we build models on top of that, which we build, as in we train and we serve them. And we call that the ML platform layer. So that's the second layer. Right about 2022, even before ChatGPT came along, we started doing a lot of modeling with large language models. Back then it was GPT-3, before, you know, ChatGPT came along, and you know, we started calling it the layer called the LLM layer. Now we call it the GenAI platform layer, so that forms the third layer. And then we have a layer on top which we call the UI-UX layer, which we added last year because we looked at all our applications and we saw that the generative AI space has really transformed how users interact, right? So gone are the days of static dashboards and all that, and people ask questions and they expect an answer and they expect dynamic visualization. So we really needed some common UI UX elements, so we added that layer. So if you look at it, data comes in, transform, you know, data transformations, data joins, etc., happen at the data layer. Models are built and served at the ML layer. The copilots, or the way of interacting with either the data or models in a natural language, happens in the GenAI layer. And then visualizations, which have become kind of GenAI driven now, happen at the top layer. And if you add all of them, or even if you add a few of them, because we have made it very composable and loosely coupled, you get essentially a user interacting with a copilot or some kind of a dashboard, and you know, that's how it goes for us.
Well, so this is really interesting, because in my mind, at least, I was thinking of, you know, generative AI and predictive AI as sort of two different sort of AI technologies almost competing with each other. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you actually think about those as just part of the stack.
Yes, absolutely. For us, we've always seen predictive AI as the, you know, call it predictive AI, but essentially it's the machine learning models that helps you do the predictions, or sometimes you call it the discriminative models that helps you do saying whether something is A or B, class A or class B, whatever we call it. That whole layer we call predictive AI. And I think we've always known, because we've known the internals of how LLMs work, we know that to a large extent, these large language models are not supposed to do many of the mathematical operations or optimizations or predictive AI things that people think they would do. So we've always seen them as complementary. And generative AI for us was, the modern generative AI models, or LLMs, were finally the stage that, other than it generating text or helping do language or unstructured data tasks, it started doing something interesting for us. It started doing connecting the layers for us, or connecting the dots for us, because we realized that when our end user persona asks a question or expects an answer, the answer comes in many forms. Many times it comes as asking something directly from the data, but sometimes it comes from asking something to be predictive out of the data and giving that prediction as a response, or a simulation to be run and giving a explanation of that simulation as a response. So for us, we look all these as tools, and we literally call these tools.
Right.
In fact, OpenAI calls them tools now as well. And we started adopting the, so for us, data is a tool, predictive model is a tool, a simulation model is a tool. And generative AI forms a layer that can translate a user prompt or what they expect to know as a layer that knows how to use these tools to generate a response.
So this is quite interesting. So just kind of backing up, right? Like, when you're talking about discriminative AI or discriminative models,
yep,
this is the classic classifier, a regression model that people would think of.
Correct.
And so what I'm understanding from what you're saying is the orchestration capabilities of using multiple data sources, multiple discriminator models, and then, you know, tying it back to the user experience is something that Gen AI is playing a role. Is that right?
That's where it forms the glue for us that connects it all. So you call it orchestration in many circles. People call it reasoning. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, looking at something that your end user is asking and being able to break it into steps, knowing that you can answer those things with a set of tools you have, or you have to invent something to, you know, do. If you give it generic capabilities, for example, because, you know, all these models have the capability to write code or do its own data processing and all that. So yes, from orchestration, reasoning, this is how we use it as a glue layer, but we use it for things it's good at as well. So sometimes you need to just summarize.
Right.
And so, right, and sometimes you just need it as a pure language model that's trying to do entity extraction or, right, you know, all that. So all the above, but for me, the where the models became really good at is this orchestration or reasoning, or you call it. It's not the same as human reasoning, but it is quite transformative, because having the ability to write code, understand schemas, and being able to say things should be done, step one this, step two that, you know, and just play around with whether it's regular databases or with graph-based databases and schemas, that really made it, just transformative for us. And it allowed us, in a way, to create experiences where now users don't have to click on three different tabs and copy paste things from one tab to another to make it work, but really just frame it as the task that they're trying to do.
Right.
And expect us to know how to do that task.
Well, that's super interesting. I feel like we could end the podcast now. We've all learned something. But the notion of an LLM as this orchestration, reasoning, direction on top of some of these core capabilities. So let's go back to that vertical topic.
Uh-huh.
You know, all the money is getting spent today in training models and the euphoria of everything that's happening in our AI bubble here. Of course, the payout's going to come from applications of this in the real world, from the verticals, from the users. I think you have a super unique view being on one of the companies that has managed to monetize this technology. So maybe start with just, what do you see so far in terms of enterprise monetization? What are the keys to success? What are people doing right? What are they doing wrong?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there is, with AI, there is always been hype, right? And there has always been the reality. I'm actually a believer that most of the hype is real. We just have to give it time to play out, right? And we have to be a little more patient with it. What I think is absolutely real is that whether it's predictive AI was being deployed in a lot of enterprises already, right? Everything to wherever you had rule-based systems to replace it with some kind of decisioning systems, and however they are making those decisions, I think we've had a lot of successful deployments. Even in Symphony AI, for the last 4 to 5 years, we've had a lot of successful predictive AI deployments. And there we were entering this sort of phase of, okay, now that it's deployed, how do we know it's working correctly? How do we know it doesn't degrade over time and so on? So we had moved on in that maturity phase to start, right. That deployment was reading
life cycle.
Yeah. But I mean, there are certain industries we operate in where, if you think about AI needs data, the data has to be in a certain shape and form, and it has to be available. And not everything is on the cloud. Most of the things are on factory floors, and data is not there. You hardly have CPUs and not GPUs to run these models. And so there are certain verticals like industrial and manufacturing in which we operate, which are by definition or by design slightly behind in that life cycle. But where I'm optimistic is that with generative AI coming in, I think if you look at the whole stack, you have to almost see it a little differently, right? You, you don't have to, if you don't need very sophisticated predictive models, you can let GenAI or LLMs use a Python predictive library to do basic predictions for you. If you let the user, play with a copilot that's asking that questions, and if you somehow enable that data to be delivered in a way that the LLM is expected to run. So we are in a very interesting world where I almost see like some of these industries can almost skip a generation. Right. They don't have to go through
they can skip 3G and 4G and just go straight to 5G.
Yes, go straight to 5G. Yeah. And I think that's what's
particularly in manufacturing, industrial, these places where.
Absolutely. Some places in retail, particularly in industrial manufacturing, some places in the traditional media industry and how that is run and so on. I think finance is a little, more advanced. Those companies, big banks, have had the AI ML knowledge. But I think each of these verticals industries are on a different life cycle, and it feels like we can, for some of them, we can have them skip generations and deliver immediate value to the end user.
So without the monetization, really what I'm hearing is that earlier we used to, at some point in time, hire programmers, take a process architecture, turn it into code. That was, in the 1994s, that was like a productivity boost promise, right? Like, and in a certain extent, that kind of landed in the industries. Like, I don't have to wait to book my airline ticket. I can wake up in the middle of the night, go to a website and book it. It seems absurd even talking about it, but that's the reality, right? Like, we've automated those systems. Then came a frontier where we said, okay, there are rule-based processes that we had to manually code. Might as well get the machine to learn it. And so we've taken the inputs and the outputs, and we have the discriminator models learn those rules in many circumstances. And now with GenAI, that paradigm is going up-leveling a little bit more. It seems like what you're saying is the next wave of monetization in these laggard adopters can come from them leapfrogging the first and the second stage by just having the data in the right form, so that we can ask questions to GenAI, which are process-oriented, and then it orchestrates or figures out what is the right code to call, right API to write, and what are like the tools available at its own disposal that it can use to construct a sequence chain that answers the relevant question. Is that what you're kind of articulating?
Yeah, exactly. That's where I'm going. And I would say even the data doesn't have to be in a great shape, because with these multimodal models coming in, you could imagine the input being a set of pages or PDFs, and you don't necessarily have to go through the traditional, first I'll wait to scan these PDFs and all of that. So, or to an end user, you could just hold a phone and take a picture or a video, and you could ask a question of it as if the digitization of that will already being done. So I think that's the super exciting part. I do think it'll skip a few generations exactly the way you said.
So what does it mean, like, in terms of a persona, right? Like, so what does it mean for a financial crime persona here? And how is that sort of different? Because what you've described is pretty much a general AGI directional tendency, right? Like, we're having a human being that is kind of, I'm anthropomorphizing it, but there is a human being that can sort of think about what are the tools at the disposal, and it's the human being is kind of, doing a task.
Yeah.
So what does it mean to be a persona-specific AI there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there is a lot of value in looking at it the AGI way. The persona-specific, where the vertical specificity plays is those tools need to be vertical specific in my mind, right? So for example, I was saying, yes, on the industrial manufacturing floor, maybe you don't need a very sophisticated predictive maintenance model. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But you can enable an end user to ask a basic forecasting question without having a very sophisticated predictive modeling question. But in the financial crime space, for example, you do need very sophisticated you know, money laundering or fraud detection models, because the task that they are trying to solve and the way they were trained is very, very specific. And these generic models out there will not be able to do it right now. I think we are still very early in this concept of pre-trained forecasting model, for example. There have been some attempts in terms of what's called time GPT and all that, but they're very, very far from domain-specific forecasting models. I think taking financial crime detection or detecting that a malicious activity happens, the true positives you have there are so low that the importance of having these specific models is very, very high there. So so the tools there, for example, that the user is using, if the end user was asking a generic forecasting model whether that's a crime or not, it will be very far in accuracy from the actual predictive model that you have. Can it, with enough data given, you know, learn it as a general concept? Maybe, but that data is not available out there. You know, it's the data is sitting in with the banks, with the customers, in their perfect silos. That's not getting joined anywhere. That's not available as open data sets to learn from anywhere. So whenever this data, and especially the learning elements, true positives, negatives, et cetera, human labels are available in, you know, specific silos, I think the importance of these predictive or discriminative tools continues to live. And the way you think of achieving that AGI is you at least expect some kind of a reasoning layer. And again, reasoning I'm using in a very specific LLM term. I think that itself is very far from how human reasoning goes. But once you give them the tools and you say, this is a very good financial crime detection model, make sure to use it when you're trying to do it. Don't use your own internal, right. You know, knowledge.
Right. Don't do it yourself.
Yeah. I think that seems to be the right way of approaching it right now. But I think in many cases, I'm still a believer in at least thinking of it in an AGI way, right? Like thinking of these things as tools and thinking of a layer that does reasoning. Because if you don't, then you end up, you know, it at least gives me and us as a company a lot of clarity on what our role to play here is. Because in many cases, even this reasoning, for example, is a vertical specific exercise. So we have vertical specific LLMs, which we train with many examples of what breaking a problem down into steps means. Maybe in the next few iterations of OpenAI or Claude or wherever, that step gets learned automatically. But in practically speaking right now, we play a role there as well. And we definitely play a role in getting these vertical specific predictive tools the best that they can be.
But it sort of tees up the notion that in some of these verticals, it's almost a good, better, best, where I can just natively layer the stack in. I can get some capability out today. Then as I get more sophisticated, that's going to get better and better. But it seems to me that do I get day one benefit or not?
Yeah.
Is there an easy path to day one benefit? Is pretty critical to adoption and to enterprises to open wallets. And so what's that journey to sort of day one value in the customers that you see?
I'll take an example of some of the applications we are delivering now to customers, right? Which are really going live. And these are these co-pilots, for example, right? So you want to say that once this co-pilot is adopted by an end user, they are getting that 50 to 70% productivity that we are claiming. And the way to do it is right at the time at which you design it, you go after the use cases and understanding where does this person's time go the most. And sometimes you're really surprised.
It's almost like a design thinking problem.
Exactly, right? And I think at Symphony AI, I keep saying this, one of the things that I really, really liked coming out of Microsoft, not that Microsoft doesn't do it, but I think by nature, being very vertical focused company, from day one, we have product managers who used to be those people and those personas in their early lives. We have a person in the team, a PM, who used to be an investigator herself 10 years ago. We have a person who used to be a store manager at a store
right.
Himself. Right. And you know, when we build these solutions, when we think, you know, okay, how will we get those 50% gains? And this lady here shows, my time used to go in here. And they're like, okay, perfect. You know, you start like that. And so, of course, you go through user research right after that. You recruit your first 2 or 3 or 5 first users. But like, you know, right from the onset, you know where the time goes. Right.
You
and
have
you're
intuition.
Looking, yeah. Correct. Yeah.
The I'll challenge that notion of productivity a little bit, uh-huh. and I'm kind of challenging it for a good
like
reason.
We're going to get into the economics here.
So yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, in 1990s, when computers came about, there was this big bet. When economists talk about productivity, there is like a ratio of, you know, output to input that they go for, which is like total factor of productivity. And that promise for computers, I don't think landed, and I think most economists would agree that the TFP, the total factor of productivity, didn't just jump like by a huge number, right? When it comes to these 50-70% productivity estimates that we get, some of it, you know, I was part of early studies that measured the success in GitHub as an example. Some of it is around tasks that are mundane. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, there's like a set of API, you know, everyone who's kind of doing data wrangling for like a soft computing application would at some point in time use the same set of APIs. And so those tasks, I think there is definitely a value in automating, and there is, you know, 50-70% productivity gains in doing that very quickly. However, there are tasks that get very specific to the problem at hand, mm-hmm. at which point in time these boilerplate productivity measures don't very translate very clearly, right? Like you cannot say, hey, you'd get the same 50% throughout. Maybe the productivity gain then comes from a model user, like somebody who's new to the field getting better at their role. But I'm curious to see, like, how do you guys measure your productivity, right? Like, how does that land? Is it like an input-output based? Is it based on this set of small tasks?
No, I understand what you're saying. I think I remember seeing in the Davos summit also, there was this question on really, when was the last time automation has really improved the productivity curve? And it was around when PCs were getting invented. Like that was a lot, like last 20 something years, we haven't really changed as much. I understand that perspective. I think for us, it's some of our KPIs are very, very simple, right? There is, given the, like in the financial crime space, the regulations we have in when a bank sees a fraudulent activity happening, the set of activities they have to do to file with a regulator, it's very well defined, right? And it's so the amount of time that there's that goes in those cases is very well defined. So they have to, so the number of cases they are really able to handle in a day or in a week is our measure. Now, whether that time goes in getting true productivity or not, I think it's a deeper question. I don't have a great response to that. I will add one thing there, though, to the example you had. You know, a big killer of productivity sometimes is people asking some other expert for something that they don't know, but requires them to do it, right? So a most common example, like for example, happens a lot in retail CPG is the end users are these, marketing managers or category managers. Or they know a lot about what they do, but when they have to pull some other data or they have to do some analysis, they have to eventually go to a SQL database and they would go to a team of analysts. And, you know, either the team of analysts is remote or they don't know how to code, right?
Right. So they can human API.
Yeah. So human serves as the API. And then, you know, if you give them something that can write SQL or can do something, I think that really short circuits that weight. You know, I have this very, very interesting instance I always relate to. My wife works for a CPG company, and there were times when she would say, I've asked my team of analysts to get me this, and then she'd wait for 2 days till they get their response. I'm like, just learn SQL. and you know, it's not as easy said as being done, because it's not just the problem of learning SQL. You have to know the integration points, and then slightly different for Snowflake versus someone. Like, you know, it gets hard. But if you can solve that problem, for example, then that's a lot of, you know, productivity. I don't know what you call it, but you know, like when you're solving a problem, if you had all the tools available to do it then, your mind is active and you're doing it right now, and then you're totally focused. If I were to tell you you're solving a problem and you reached step two and I'll give you the data in 2 days, and then you need to, you know.
I think this is a super interesting question. It goes back to Adarsh of who are we helping? You know, is it possible that an expert in flow state is 10 times more productive? And so that removing that drudgery, removing that 50% allows them to stay in that flow state longer, allows them to do something that they weren't going to be able to do before. And all of a sudden you have this outsized home run gains.
I feel that about myself, right? Just earlier today.
I think
a
lot of us feel that way.
Yeah. Earlier today I was thinking about some financial reporting and I was like, where did this money go? Right? And if I had that answer, you know, right there and then, I would go the 3 steps after that and I would solve that thing, right? And now it has gone as an email to someone who's pulling in that data, and now it'll wait for my time in my calendar to be available for me to answer it. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, I in my most productive state in those 15 minutes, if I had that, I could get a lot more done then.
Yeah, I think breaking down as the enterprise, you know, we've all value sold in the enterprise, and you're either making a cost argument or a top line argument. But as we really get into this, I mean, Adarsh, I think sort of breaking down and helping people understand where is the sources of value, you know, how do you approach that from an economic lens?
Yeah, it's actually a great question. I think now the overlay kind of makes sense, right? Like, which is there are certain KPIs that directly translate into money. Ticket resolution rate. Let's take a contact center application.
Yeah.
There, the number of tickets that you resolve directly results in economic value. I think the other day I was doing the mental math on McDonald's. Like the peak hour traffic and the speed with which they process orders changes the game entirely in terms of the whole business value. And the reason is they are assets that are provisioned for the peak. You want to have enough number of people come through the driveway, and then you want to be able to service the orders. So if you double the number of peak orders that you can serve, you would actually, you know, probably
you'd have your asset base.
That's right, exactly. You can have the asset base, which means 10x the valuation for the entire organization. And I feel like what I've heard from you, Raj, is that if we focus on some of these KPIs that are business centric and have real translations, and then focus on them as the productivity delta measures, that's where the early adopters could already see some of the gains come about.
And
just kind of dragging that notion a little bit further, how far are we from say an AI even telling us what are those process choke points? I could look at my business processes overall, and then have someone even evaluate and tell me, here are your process choke points, here are your KPIs. How far are we away from that?
Yeah, I think there's this whole area of process mining that many companies were in. It kind of got hot the last 3-4 years ago, and then it's kind of cooled down a little bit. But I think we are. It's something we are actually trying. I can say in the industrial manufacturing space, understanding a business process, just being able to discover it directly from the data is the problem number one. Because many times you have a lot of data coming from IoT and all that, and you want to see the dependency graph on what depends on what, you know, it's. I think if we are able to solve that, that itself is an interesting problem. But then from that, let's say you build out this process graph or process map, and I think it's a pretty well studied field. The problem has been gathering the data to measure it correctly. But I do feel like. Like we are trying it in the industrial and manufacturing space, especially, where understanding a production process, for example, end-to-end, and being able to say that some data going wrong in that front of that process affects something downstream, and what effect could have on the, you know, supply after that. How close are we? It's hard for me to say. How close are we?
So this is like the problem of not having a digital twin of the factory.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I think everyone's stuck on having those perfect digital twins. I do think, at least in early prototypes, I cannot go too deep into it, but GenAI has a very good role to play in just being able to get you started very, very fast. And you know, look at the data and suggest a few processes that could be the possible graphs you're looking at and so on. But yeah, I think everyone kept talking about the digital twin, but AI and AI people stopped looking at that a couple of years ago.
This harvesting of latent data, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, there's data that is data exhaust. It's data that's out there in the system we've never been able to harvest that.
Yeah.
That's, of course, super important to us here at Western Digital because you got to store all that and keep it around. So we're super motivated to help with that problem. But it seems like just understanding that data is harvestable.
Yeah.
Like those log files, they exist. They're accessible. A reasonable modicum of data engineering would allow you to get at that, and now maybe I can get started in this very sort of low cost fashion.
Yeah. And I remember one example where the hardest thing to capture digitally in a process used to be, again, a communication that one person has to do with someone else. So we were looking at where does expense reporting gets as a process is the hardest. And you'd imagine that if it was all done in one tool, you'd understand it, but it's not, because you go to your phone and you find something, that a picture of a receipt you had taken, you email somebody. And I think getting that data all in one place has been the hard part, which is where I now remember I saw someone's comment on Twitter or LinkedIn the other day, which was very interesting. It was a note to Google that said, you know everything about my life.
Right. Can't you help me more?
If I were to model my processes, you are the best at being able to do that. I think that's a huge opportunity for a consumer company like Google or Apple to be going after. But whatever applies to enterprises does apply to this space. Yeah.
So let's change the gears a little bit to the people. It seems like I know in my organization, you know, a few thousand people, thinking about who has the ability to conceptualize what's possible here, who has the ability to spot these issues, how do I activate the organization to help me find and create value? What experience have you guys? Do you have a consultative approach to your selling process, or are you recognizing? Are you trying to find AI champions and partner with those champions, or how do you kind of get this ball rolling?
Are you talking about people within our customer organizations?
How do you get your customer champions? Do you have enough customer champions? How do you create more customer champions? What makes the best customer champion? Seems like that's a really critical role.
Absolutely. It's a very critical role. I think there's no one good answer for it. We go through it at various directions. Obviously, we have AEs and, you know, our sales and customer success reps who have these champions that they are connected to. And if they're not, they keep trying to find them. We go at it from a, finding the right stakeholder as well. So sometimes you go bottoms up or tops down, whatever works. I think having the AI hype helps in that thing, that everyone now wants to be a champion at least. And so people have started reaching out and saying, oh, I heard from you and back then I didn't pay attention and now I want to think about it because I've been asked what to do about it. So I think that has helped a lot to make everyone think about it because, you know, half the people used to ignore it before. So we go at it from all angles. But I think for us, the going at it from the use cases and the value delivered is always been very critical, right? So once we have a new product in the market, and once we have the first two or three customers, that case study and that example.
Now you have something to scale.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we always go with that. I think one thing which is embedded in our DNA at Symphony AI, which really starts at our founder and going down at the CXO levels and so on, has been, at least when we go for pricing and how should we GTM one of our products, we always at least think about the value angle as well. It's not always Absolutely. That we are able Absolutely. To do that. So we look at, if X dollars is the value delivered, then our price should be X by whatever, right?
So we like to talk about network externalities there, right? Or, benefits of scaling. How much cross-learning is there? Like, if you have three customers, say, in a space,
yep.
would it benefit your organization in a way to be able to learn from patterns that you see in one organization that you can actually apply in another? Like, let's say that, there's a financial crime happening in Bank A.
Yep.
You've seen that as part of your onboarding of Bank A. Now that you're onboarding Bank B and C, is your system better off because now you have Bank A, B, and C together?
System as in, is our model better off?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's sort of the analogy here. This problem is essentially solved in security, mm-hmm. which is, we all said, security is such a huge problem. Every time there's a threat, we're going to allow you to report that threat signature back to a security body who can then put that in a database and yep. get that turned around for the industry. I think the analogy here is if there's value coming out of my data as the enterprise,
yep.
do I say, well, I want to control that, or maybe it's my enlightened self-interest to pass that value through and such that we can all benefit from that
yeah.
that gain?
Yeah, I think as a...
And I don't know what the right answer is.
It depends. I mean, in real enterprise scenarios, it depends what's in it for the enterprise, for that company, right? So in financial crime space, you can make a case, and we are trying to make a case, that everyone having right. some sort of knowledge would be good for one bank to, just we are after the same bad criminals, right? And so...
Right, competing with each other on the basis of better financial crime detection doesn't seem very smart.
Exactly.
We all come together.
Exactly. The problem is the data is still the same. The data is still very private, their customers' data. So I think unless you solve that hurdle, people are not worried about competition in that sense, but they are worried about their data. So... but I think with the new technologies like data clean rooms and privacy vaults and all that, we are trying to bridge that gap. That is one area where, we believe having a consolidated approach or a consortium approach might work out. We want to be big in that space. In other spaces, there's not a very clear case to be made that there's something in it for the company to let us learn from the data. I think we are also very careful. And I mean, if you look at AI in general, you know that there's a lot of pre-training or pre-learning you could do just with external data as well, or just with anonymized. And right now we have, very good synthetic data use cases. I think synthetic data or artificial data has come back roaring with right. the Gen AI space. So you could do a lot in that space as well. In the case of retail, there is a case to be made that retailers and CPGs are two sides of the coin. And a retailer, in fact, in their day-to-day business, it's a very interesting dynamics because they're always negotiating, right? There is in it for the retailer, for the CPG to put in more money. CPGs want more out of the retailers. And so we play in that space. We call it the data monetization space or the insights monetization. So we act as the central, you know, intermediary of sorts that where the products that we are building, for example, the Copilots, they have a certain view to the retailer, and they have a narrower view or whatever the retailer wants to the CPG as well.
So you can express some
yes.
capabilities.
Yeah, there's like a federated learning equivalence that seems possible with the Gen AI, right? Like, because if there is a company A, which is really good with prompt engineering, then there goes your benefit in one sense, right? Like where you could actually have the company A essentially be selling their own capability in a whole new manner. You know, it's like every company becomes a consulting company in one, in some sense. Yeah. And so, like, is that what I'm hearing from you?
That you use that phrase. I didn't use the technology phrase for it, but yeah, we have a federated learning architecture. We use it both for predictive models, and now we had a federated LLM training framework as well. I will not say we've successfully deployed it, but you have to prove a lot of things here before you could go mass market here. But definitely. So when I talk about our innovation team, federated learning is one of our big innovation buckets there.
Where the data is walled off between different companies.
But the learning can be shared. Can be shared. And as long as you ensure that no data, and the data or PII defined in a way by the customer, none of that ever leaves that boundary.
Well, and of course, in the modern large-scale enterprise, those walls are inside the enterprise are just as important as they are, you know, outside the enterprise from a data privacy and an internal governance perspective. I mean, as I listen to you, it's interesting. I think there's one school of thought, and there's that, you know, enterprises, we'll call this an LLM-centric school of thought. The enterprises are going to have these sort of fleets of LLMs. They'll be optimized for the different users, finance or HR or engineering, and you'll have this sort of native LLM on top of my data. When I replay, I think, the Symphony AI story, it's actually very different. It says, no, we're going to think deeply about personas and use cases and business processes, and we're building these stacks that are in fact, they're not just helping you do your job, they do the job better than anyone else has ever done that job before. And you know, this tension between this horizontal and vertical nature, I think, is going to be a super interesting thing to watch this play out.
Yeah, that is correct. And there are some things which will be probably more horizontal. I think we are talking about, for example, enterprise search.
Probably
horizontal. But even there, the way financial questions play out versus how a HR document play out.
And it's not just that. I experience this every day because, in theory, in our enterprise, you know, I can see more than everybody in my organization.
Yep.
But encoding that into some sort of LLM search capability is ludicrous.
Yep.
Now I actually need my entire my specific LLM with only my data, which makes no sense at all. So how you navigate data boundaries in an organization and actually achieve this is
I think the way we are looking at it is that go a level above the LLMs into the concept of agents, and so agents are like kind of LLM driven decision systems that are somewhat autonomously executing, all right? So if you think an agent would be driving
I would have an agent. So let's just say that I'm a financial controller. There's a financial controller agent. They would have certain role-based access control, and they would go do some roles. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes. So what we were talking about as LLM. Every enterprise will have their own LLMs. I'm saying that level of if you go one level higher, you would say every enterprise will have their agents, which are driven by
agents.
LLMs.
Right.
Yes, and the agents will know how to interact with other agents, or interface with other agents. There'll be common contracts between how agents interact with. And in that case, for example, if you were to use a vertical specific use case, instead of trying to do it your own way, you would just call some other agent which is better than you at doing it.
Rob's point of challenge there becomes even more difficult in terms of a threat model, right? Like, because you could, for example, have this financial controller agent that has access to data, and then there is this, you know, XYZ agent, maybe yeah. even an adversarial agent, right? Like that got access to the enterprise. And then knowing the contract of exchange, the XYZ agent would then have to ask, could ask adversarial questions to the financial controller agent and extract information. So how does that yeah. sort of get walled?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that has to be, I think what you're talking about is how does, you know, there's all these concepts of, you know, how LLMs can be tricked into giving responses when in really strange ways. Just yesterday, I was reading a paper where if you ask it to answer a question in natural language, it will not because it has been guardrailed. But if you give it an image with that question asked as dots, it can be tricked into...
It can interpret it.
Yes. It because you stopped it from answering it in text. It's like I tell my child, if someone asks you that question, you know, don't answer it. But if someone shows you a pamphlet of it, then you can answer it. So I think over time we will learn, but I would say everything first starts at the data and API level access controls and so on. So that's why for us, instead of, you know, taking the approach that you would train an LLM on every data source, everything you have, an LLM asks a tool, tool is driven by an API, API has a role-based access, that accesses data, data has that rollback access, and somewhere in this point, it would just say, no, this person doesn't have the access to answer that. And so maybe that's too conservative, but we almost want to start there and just limit our use cases if that's the case. On our research phase and all that, we can try everything that we want to, but like when it comes to production, that's the approach we take.
So we're getting close to the end here. Mm-hmm. By way of a call to action, I'd love to sort of hear your perspective for the enterprise leaders and the business leaders out there of, you know, how do you get started, right? What's the path forward? I've got 100 different use cases and 100 different applications and 100 different people giving me ideas. What's your best advice in terms of sorting that out?
it's a tough question right now, and I mean it's everyone's being asked it. I know there's budgets being created. There's people
consulting firms.
I know there's consulting firms.
Value at stake analysis.
yeah, and there's vendors like us out there to also get that budget right. So I think as any leader in an organization, I've got to look at what all do I want to take up as like what are my core strengths of my team and so on, and what are the strengths I want to build going in the future, right? So maybe I do want to build a strength of my data lake being reorganized in a way in the future it can be queried with Gen AI, right? And then that's a bet I will take. It'll take maybe a year, 2 years to do that. But I will find a vendor who then not just shows me the data as a black box, but actually is open to saying, okay, I'll work on your data with you, and then you own it. And you own the API layer of it, because not only will my product work on top of that, I will leave you with the data in a shape where your other products can work
right.
like that.
Right.
And in my role, that's a lot of the times when we talk to customers, we are open to it. Like we kind of go in and say, hey, we don't want it to be all just magic and all that. And so I think on the flip side, that's how, but at the same time, maybe there are some use cases you want to drive and accomplish some real gains very fast. And you don't care about this long-term approach in which you just approach a vendor who does that for you. And so like, same with enterprise search. Do you want to own the search index going forward a little bit, right?
Right.
Versus you just want to forget about it.
Right.
And then you would approach it a little differently.
Right.
And I think at least people should ask these questions on what do I own versus, you know, what do I not own? Right. And sometimes I think it's okay to be a little, you know, a quarter, 2 quarters slower, but get it right in looking at the stack and understanding what goes behind the scenes. If this is my data, then these should be my APIs, and this is my time to get my APIs right, and I might as well do it. As an engineering leader, you could do that. Obviously, as a business, finance, or other leaders, you've got other ways to look at it. There's obviously the other angle of your own productivity and productivity of your own teams. I think that's a very different question, and there are different vendors in that space. But I do think there is a level of upskilling and getting very familiar with these concepts everybody has to take. I think there is no turning around. I'm a firm believer. I've been in the AI space. There is no turning around from Gen AI. It's here, and everyone just has to find a way to adopt it.
Well, Raj, thank you so much for joining us. I feel like I've learned a lot about enterprise AI and how you guys are thinking about Symphony AI, applying it to these real problems. So great. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I also enjoyed the conversation. I've got some food for thought on the economics and productivity angle. But yeah, I also really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us for the Silicon Economics Podcast.
If you enjoyed that episode, like, share, and subscribe. Please leave your feedback and be on the lookout for our next episode.